acquisition of 11513 Real One.
Mr. Bell, Real One. Can you tell me, first of all, how and when you came to be connected with Nigeria?
Yes, when I was at Oxford, I decided that I was going to go for the Colonial Administrative Service and try for Northern Nigeria. I was successful in this, and so after I'd taken my degree, I had a year's administrative course, Colonial Services course in Oxford, and then in July 1940, we set sail for Nigeria as civilians, and we found our uniform as officer cadets on the boat, and we got ashore as such in Lagos in August 1940, and then went up to an octu in Kano, which lasted, I think, about 6 weeks. And then we were commissioned, and I went to the 4th Battalion of the Nigeria Regiment, which was then in Victoria in the British Cameroons, and we stayed there for about a year, I think. I was on detachment of the platoon, watching the mouth of the river leading up to, what's the name of that place? The capital of the French Cameroons.
Yaoundé?
It could be. I don't... Anyway, slightly before that, the Free French had gone up there by canoes at night and turned the Cameroons from Vichy to Free French, and I was put at the mouth of this river to stop the reverse happening. And of course, nobody ever tried anything of the sort. And
did you come into much contact with the French officials there?
No, not when I was there. Later, when Battalion went from Victoria up to Bamenda for a dry season training, we went through... the road went through the French part of the Cameroons, as, of course, the road system had been planned when it was all one under the Germans. And we went to this place... it was our sort of provincial headquarters. I'm afraid I've forgotten its name. And we had a dinner with the chef de cercle there. And we found it easier to...
Who was he?
The chef de cercle, the French civil official. I think he was called the chef de cercle. It might have been in Goundary. Anyway, we found it easier to talk to his rather attractive daughters in Hausa than in French, which was quite entertaining.
Why had you been so attracted to Nigeria?
I think I was interested in indirect rule, which, of course, Northern Nigeria was famous for, and which, of course, later I practiced.
Indirect rule?
Yes.
Why were you so attracted to that?
I thought it was a good way of doing things. You took the existing political situation, the emirs and their traditional councils, and used them rather than getting rid of them and setting up something entirely Western, which the French did. I think probably the French worked better in the subsequently than ours did, judging by the results after they all became independent. Still, there we are.
So you didn't feel that Westernization would be a good thing for the people there?
I don't think they wanted it. They were Muslims, and they reckoned that their culture was adequate for them, and therefore until quite in the 1950s, I suppose, they began to see that... Western education was necessary, and they altered their views. But until then, they'd rather been against learning English, for example, in large quantities.
Did you find it easy to learn Hausa?
Reasonably. I was never a terrific Hausa speaker, partly because I served a lot of the time in areas where Hausa was a second language, not the original, not the first language. It's an unusual language, I suppose, in that the tenses of the verbs are in the pronoun, not in the verb itself, mostly. Fairly easy to talk, what we call kitchen Hausa. Difficult to talk classical Hausa.
How did you find the troops of the 4th Battalion of the Nigeria Regiment?
They were very... they were fairly primitive. And when I first joined the battalion, it was a regular battalion. And most of the private soldiers had several years' service. NCOs, of course, had up 20 or more years. And then... after I'd been with them for a few months, pretty well all the regulars were taken away. Well, we left a skeleton of regular NCOs, and we received an equivalent draft of raw recruits whom we then had to train. And with those, we went round to Sierra Leone after about a year. The regular troops, of course, were used to raise other battalions. And then when we were in Sierra Leone, having trained that lot up, shortly before, I think, we left for Nigeria, 43, the same sort of thing happened again. We were milked of another large number of troops and again had raw recruits. And when we went to Burma, it was with some regular NCOs, some NCOs whom we'd trained ourselves over a period of years, and a lot of very raw private soldiers. And we would suffer from that later, I think.
What did you think of them as raw material, as soldiers?
When they were trained, they were good. When a man is untrained, he obviously isn't as good. They were very good. Their stamina, physical stamina, was excellent. And when they realised what they were about, they were pretty good soldiers, I think. They often didn't, though. And we lacked experienced junior NCOs. I think that was one of the main troubles. Also, the same sort of thing happened with the Europeans. The West African forces were always staffed from British regiments, so that there was no actual cadre of West African Europeans, as it were. And we went into Burma with quite a lot of BNCOs. We had them down to sergeant, who hadn't any experience with African troops, and also a number of junior officers who were the same. And they found difficulty, of course, communicating with the troops who didn't speak English.
Do you think that schooling on the part of the Africans would have had much effect on them as for their potential as soldiers?
I think it rather depend on what sort of schooling it was. Occasionally, when we were in West Africa, the missionaries got it, one or two of our men. And I think I remember one Muslim sergeant who was a very good chap. The missionaries got him, and he became quite useless after that because they destroyed his belief in his Muslim faith without really putting anything substantial in its place. And I think that was really the trouble with a lot of missionary work. When we were in Sierra Leone, there was a Roman Catholic father who'd been there for something like 40 years, and I remember asking him how many people he'd converted to Roman Catholicism during that time, and he thought for a little bit, and he said, I think one.
What were the manifestations of this chap's uselessness after he...
Well, his general sort of moral fibre wasn't there. He became uncertain of himself, whereas he had been sure of himself with a lot of self-confidence and ability. That seemed to be drained out of him. I think because his belief in Allah had been sapped without his belief in the Christian God having taken its place to any degree.
Do you remember his name?
I think it was Kadiri Kano, but I wouldn't be absolutely certain.
Did he come from Kano?
Oh, yes. Well, the Kano province.
Was there much variation amongst the recruits according to where they came from?
Oh, some were better than others, I think, yes. We had a lot from the Tiv, who were good. They were also called Bunshi. They were not Muslim, they were pagan. Most of them came from the northern parts and were Muslim. Very good ones came from up by Lake Chad.
Would you ever get any southerners in those days? Then?
Yes, you had southerners mostly as clerks and signallers, where English and writing and reading were required. You didn't get southerners as ordinary fighting soldiers. Yet they were definitely not recruited for that reason that they were not, in those days, considered good material, I think.
Did they perform the function which they were required to perform well?
Oh, yes, they did.
What kind of relationship did people like yourself from Britain have with the Nigerian soldiers?
I think we got along with them very well. We didn't have any sort of social contact with them, I suppose, because our two ways of living were very different. We looked after them, and they looked after us in their way. I think we got along very well with them. But there was, not so much of them personally, but we had a number of Polish officers, for example, posted to us before when we were in Sierra Leone. They didn't speak English, and of course they didn't speak any African language, and they were rather difficult to deal with until they settled in. Rather an extraordinary thing, sending people like that out. We couldn't talk to them, and of course the troops couldn't. I think there were six of them one time, but they didn't. I think they'd all left by the time we went into Burma.
What did the attitude of the African soldiers seem to be towards you? Did they ever show any curiosity about Britain or ask you questions?
No, I don't think they did, really. They were dealing with something, a set of people whom they'd only known hitherto as their the people who kept law and order, the administrative service, the general civil service in Nigeria, and those who'd been in the army before, of course, came across the regular army people out there. So, in large quantities, such as we had then, the European was a strange thing to them. And, yes, I think that's right.
Was there anybody in Nigeria in those days agitating against British rule?
I don't think so. I didn't know very much about that then. There was Nnamdi Azikiwe, who eventually became president of Nigeria. I'm not quite sure when he started his agitation. It might have been then. But I didn't know about it then.
What was the attitude of the African soldiers towards service to the Crown? What do you think their motivation was?
I suppose the regular soldier became such because he wanted the money. During the war, when recruitment was enormously boosted, I rather think the system was that the district officers were asked to talk to their emirs and chiefs and see if they would encourage recruitment. And then they would have been told by their emir, go and join up. I think that's probably what happened. But again, I had nothing to do with that side of it.
What was their attitude, do you think, towards service abroad, towards leaving Africa?
I don't think they thought very much about it. They did what they were told. I think you've got to remember that when they came down to the Cameroons, most of them saw the sea for the first time. When we went from the Cameroons to Sierra Leone, we were on a Norwegian ship used as a trooper, and they had no conception of how that worked. I overheard a couple of them talking about it, and one said to the other, it had large legs which walked along the bottom of the sea. We saw, I suppose, there were dolphins or porpoises, and they were instantly identified as hippopotamus. They were very ignorant in that sort of way, unexperienced.
Did you give them lectures about what to expect with the Japanese, how to identify them and how to react to them?
Oh yes, that would be part of their training. I didn't do that myself at that stage because I was then at brigade headquarters and not with troops.
Can you tell me about going to India?
We embarked in Lagos and went in a convoy around the Cape. I think we had 4 or 5 days in the Cape. And the troops were then taken on a route march. And I think the same thing happened at Durban. And then we landed in Bombay. And by train to a place called Nasik, which is not very far from Deolale. And we there had a large tented camp. And we were there for, I suppose, 3 months or so before we started moving across to Calcutta, Chittagong, and down to this place called Chiringa, where we were there for a short while before we went east into Burma.
What was the relationship like between the African soldiers and the Indians?
Insofar as they came across them, I think they were all right. The African, of course, is a much bigger, more powerful person than the Indian. They didn't have very much contact, really, until we went into Madras after we'd come out of Burma. We were outside Madras for a time, and the troops were allowed into the city on sort of day leave. They seemed to get along with the Indians all right. Travelled in rickshaws and things like that.
So there were no problems?
I don't think so, no. The African troop was already a fairly congenial sort of person.
What, did there have to be special training in India before you went into Burma?
We did training in India, yes. From this place, Nasik, there was several large exercises. The most well-known one was exercise Headload 1, I think it was, where we had a sort of divisional exercise. Somewhere in the jungle, not very far from Nasik.
This was 81 Division?
81 Division, yes.
Was that useful?
Oh, yes, I think so. But we were... I suppose the main character of our campaign in Burma was that we had absolutely no lines of communication. We were on air supply the whole time. And I suppose we had drops about every 5 days. And we carried everything from one drop to the next, as it were. People carried about 5 days' rations on them sometimes. And then we had these auxiliary groups. They'd been about 2,000 strong, an aux group, I suppose, and each brigade had one. And they were largely carriers, unarmed carriers. And the standard load was half a hundredweight on the chap's head. But the ordinary infantry chap used to carry 100 rounds, sometimes some Ren magazines, and on occasion up to 5 days' rations. So he was really fairly heavily laden. And I doubt if troops less physically strong could have done what we did, even though had they been there, more seasoned troops, they would have had perhaps a better result against the Jap than we had, but I doubt if they'd have got there.
What did the African soldier consume in the Far East?
We had mostly what they called a compo ration, which I suppose all troops had. It came in sort of 4-gallon tins, such as kerosene was supplied in. And that had a ration in it for 8 men for 1 day, if I remember rightly. And it had tinned food in it, mostly. And the African divided each tin into 1/8 and mixed the whole lot up together, meat, fruit, the lot, and ate it like that.
So European-style food?
European-style food, most of the time. When we were lucky and there was fresh meat, then he might have had his more traditional food, which was a large quantity of some sort of cereal and meat and gravy, usually with peppers.
What was the cereal which they normally consumed?
In Nigeria?
In the Far East?
In the Far East. I've forgotten the names of the ones now. I think atta was one of them. And rice, of course.
Were they happy with the diet?
They seem to be. They're very adaptable people, I think.
What would the officers have? The same?
We had the same, yes.
But not all mixed together?
Not all mixed together. There wasn't very much chance of cooking when you were in the jungle. You had most of your food as it came out of the tin. We had tea made sometimes, and I remember in battalion headquarters we were slightly shocked to find that our various tea rations ended up in the battalion mess cook's sock, which he kept in his haversack, and when he was ordered to produce tea, he dipped it into the hot water and put it back in his haversack.
Did you have a tobacco ration?
Yes, cigarettes and pipe tobacco, and also rum, which was Rosa rum, which varied enormously to something quite reasonable to something that was quite undrinkable.
Because it was so rough?
Yes. Well, it was really, how do you describe it? More like varnish. On occasions, you just had to dip it away. It was made in India, I think, and the troops didn't get that, being Muslim largely. It was the Europeans who had it.
Did they get any alcohol at all?
No. The troops? No. No.
Did they show any desire for it?
No, I don't think so. I say most of them were Muslims, and as you know, Muslims don't drink. At any rate, in theory. And the Nigerians are pretty good on that, actually.
When did you first go into India yourself, into Burma yourself?
I think it was in December, end of December 43 when brigade headquarters moved in. I think I went ahead, actually. Yes, I was a bit ahead of brigade headquarters. I was sent forward with a section of the brigade defence platoon, which was Sierra Leone troops. And I marched in as a sort of forward party, I suppose. And I remember coming up with the CRE on a filthy night, raining in a little sort of basher, bamboo hut. And I suppose I got in looking rather dejected. He said, "Cheer up, you're seeing the world at somebody else's expense." That was, what was his name? Boggs, I think, or Bloggs. Nice job. But they were building this jeep track right through from, well, basically from Chiringa right through to Murdoch.
How do you spell Murdoch? M-O...
M-O-W-D-O-K, which was on the... just on the Indian side of the border where the Jap had been.
So what was the duty of this unit that you first went in with?
This section. I just took a section in as a... I suppose I was just a recce... a recce for brigade headquarters, I think. I'm honestly not quite sure what I was doing. I went. Anyway, I've forgotten. There must have been a purpose. But I've forgotten what it was now. But I remember walking all this way. Just with myself and about ten troops, going along this jeep track, I think, and I suppose I sent messages back saying how the progress of the track had gone on. I suppose that must have been what it was.
What did the jeep track look like?
It was just a swathe cut through the jungle, and where the track went along the bed of a river, I suppose they tried to move the worst stones so that you could get through. And occasionally there was a cutting up a hillside. The ridges at the top of the hill were extremely narrow. I mean, sometimes too narrow to take a vehicle at all. And one or two places like that, the sappers had put a timber top on with supports on either end to make it wide enough for a vehicle to go over. The jeeps were, I think, all with either divisional headquarters or the light battery. And I suppose there were probably half a dozen or so 1,500 weight trucks, each with a winch, so that you could take the wire up the hill and then it winched itself up. Otherwise, there was no... We hadn't any transport at all. And when the light battery went to India, it was on a head-load basis. They carried the guns on their heads. And on reasonable terrain, they could do about 10 miles a day like that. But when they got to India, they were given jeeps. And so the guns were towed. But they still could have been manhandled, of course. They came to pieces. And the heavier bits were carried by four men on a sling.
And it was still raining in December, was it, when you went into Burma?
Yes, but it stopped very shortly after that.
What do you remember happening next to you after this?
Well, we went forward. I suppose I had about 3 weeks at Murdoch with 4NR. They had a base there, and they were forward. To the Caradan River, and then brigade came up, and we all moved forward, crossed the Caradan, and went down the east bank, and then 4NR must have crossed over again, because it was on the west bank. That's where it had its first taste of action with the Jap. I wasn't in that. I was with brigade on the other side. That would have been in the latter part of January, I suppose.
You were telling me earlier that as GSO3 at brigade headquarters, you didn't really have much to do.
Not really, no, I didn't. You see, you had the... there was the brigade major, of course, and then on the Q side there was a DAA QMG and a staff captain. It was a brigade headquarters for a brigade group, and I suppose that was the standard establishment for a brigade group. But I don't think that we had the supporting arms that made those extra posts necessary.
So what kind of work were you doing with brigade headquarters in January? What type of jobs would you be given?
Occasional liaison jobs. Keeping the situation board up to date. The IO and I did that together, I think. But not a great deal.
How did the battalion perform on the Caledon River in January against the Japanese?